Hello and welcome to the Cinema Clash. I am Charlie Jewell of CharlieJewell.com.
And I'm Hannah Buchdahl of ChickFlix.net.
Normally, we record this on a Friday. We're recording on a Wednesday this week, so no alcohol.
I've just got my water.
It's a school night.
It is.
Another perplexing event, along with no alcohol, is our first film. An animated film, but it's not Disney. It's not Pixar. It's from Nickelodeon Films, and I'm perplexed because of the title. It is called Wonder Park. Takes place in an amusement park. Makes sense. However, the amusement park is in the film named Wonderland.
I know. I have a feeling there were a lot of things that are just a little off with this movie. It's not bad, but I think what happened was somebody didn't do their due diligence. Apparently, it was originally called Amusement Park, was the working title. And then it turned into Wonder Park. And my guess is it was too late with some kind of copyright or trademark infringement that they just weren't able to call it Wonderland, which definitely would have made more sense.
Well, I went to see, maybe this is from a TV show, so I went on Nickelodeon, did some search. No, can't find it. It's not on TV. But my kid is talking about it. How does my six-year-old know about Wonder Park if it's not on television? They're advertising in elementary schools. He's like, oh yeah, this was on our whatever. I'm like, so they're showing you commercials for films in elementary school.
However, they are planning to do a Nickelodeon spinoff, a TV series. So maybe they're just priming. Nickelodeon is probably priming their little target audience in advance with the hope that if they launch this TV series, everyone that they want to see it will have seen the film first.
For animated films, for animated fare, as far as that goes, this one's a little bit, it's not morose, but it is a little bit sadder than some. It's not your standard adventure tale of nonsense. This is actually about emotions and feelings, and I don't understand what I'm feeling, so I need to sort it out for myself by running away from math camp. our heroine, our little girl, is actually very creative. Her and her mother, voiced by Jennifer Garner, have created this entire amusement park, and it's really detailed. All the rides, all the characters, all the mascots. It's built all over her room, all over the house.
All over her imagination.
Everywhere. And it's Wonderland Park. And Mom gets sick. Mom, we don't know what it is, but Mom disappears. I have to go away for a while, honey. I'm sick. And she's very sad, and she tears down Wonder Park. She puts it all away, and it was the house. It's gotten her in trouble in the neighborhood. She caused hijinks and committed property damage. And now that Mom is gone, she doesn't know what to do. I can't do Wonder Park without Mom. So running away from math camp because she's sad and doesn't know what to do, this is one of those through a magical doorway movie. She didn't mean to go to Wonder Park. She just went through a magical doorway. And all of a sudden, it led her to the actual park that she had been dreaming of, imagining, drawing, creating construction projects out of, and she meets the mascots and the characters, and they're anthropomorphic characters. There's Boomer the Bear. There's Greta the Warthog. I remember her being voiced by Mila Kunis. There's two, I don't even know what they are, hamsters?
Yeah, I
are
they don't hamsters? Know. They, yeah. Gus and Cooper, they were the builders.
By going through these adventures and trying to save Wonder Park, because since she tore it down, the park is starting to fall apart, she comes to grips with her feelings about Mom, she'll be okay, that sort of thing. Wonder Park, I just want to say, is, it's there.
It's one of those things that the message is sweet and very simple, that we are the wonder in Wonder Park. You, Charlie, are the wonder in Wonder Park.
While as I'm wondering about Wonderland.
And your imagination comes alive, and it's about how the importance of fostering your kid's imagination and supporting that. And so this girl, June, voiced by this newcomer, Brianna Dennsky, she sort of plants the idea is that she's planted in this game maker's mind. Like she's given him this magic marker that truly is magic, and then whispers in his ear all the things, all the rides that he should build. And so when she falls silent, he doesn't have anyone whispering in his ear, and therefore he can't build any new rides. And a darkness comes over Wonderland. And so it's actually very straightforward that they need her to come back, to see the light, to help them battle the darkness and get the park up and running again. And it's parallels, of course, her real existence. So it's easy enough, I think, for the kids to follow. It does get a little sad, but this is another one of where I said it's this movie, there are things that are just a little off. I read the synopsis, the original synopsis for this film has the mother dying. And I had to go back and ask people, I was like, I don't think the mother died.
Spoilers.
But I'm just, it's important because I think they shifted something to make it less sad.
Would have been way too dark.
It would have been way too dark. And then the other weird thing about this movie is there is no director credited.
I looked for that.
The director was fired in the middle of production for sexual harassment allegations. And so there's no director listed on IMDb. There's no director listed in the credits. It was this guy, Dylan Brown, and he was accused of inappropriate conduct. And then the other weird thing where Me Too suddenly kind of cast a shadow over this movie is Jeffrey Tambor was originally to be the voice of
Boomer,
Boomer.
The Big Bear.
The Big Bear. And so it's just, I don't know. The movie's okay, but I just think that there were all these weird things that just kind of prevented it from being better.
You know, at times it reminded me of Inside Out. No, it's not near. It's not as half as good as Inside Out. That movie was phenomenal on another level. But as June goes to different parts of the park, the fireworks land or the swing zone or whatever, what have you, it reminded me of Inside Out. Let's go to this part of the psyche, or let's go to this part of the childhood rearing development. And okay, I see what you're doing here. Learn this over here, then go learn this over here. It's very episodic.
And a little bit of Up as well in there. You know, still not nearly as good, But it tries to have things that will just be also of enjoyment to the kids while they're still learning these lessons about, you know, really just using your imagination. And people will be going around saying the word splendiferous because everything in this film is, everything is splendiferous when you find the wonder. And the other thing is the chimpanzee zombies that have sort of taken over the park, and that's sort of part of what the story is that, you know, trying to retrieve the park from these chimpanzee zombies. And the other, the other main character is actually this Peanut the Ride Maker.
Oh, I thought you were going to say the porcupine, voiced by John Oliver.
No, this guy voiced by Norbert Leo Butts, who I think is also like a Broadway actor. I thought his character was just the most, I loved his voice and just, you know, that he's the one who drew the inspiration from June. And so when she stopped using her imagination and creating things, he had to stop creating things too. And I just thought that was, I just liked his character a lot. I just thought it was the most sort of, best drawn character of the bunch from the park.
Meh.
Yeah. I mean, again, it's not great, but I can totally see it as just setting the stage for these characters being in a spinoff on television on Nickelodeon. You know, they had a great little song, you know, We Are the Wonder. Or You Are the Wonder, I can't even remember. But
I remember you, I really did not want to go to this. I really didn't want to go. And you said, it's probably this year's Norm of the North. Let's just go knock it out. And it's better than Norm of the North.
It's better than Norm of the North. And it's
which is not hard to do.
Right. And again, it's just harmless and simple. And it had some weirdness going on behind the scenes with the production. But in the end, it passes. Barely.
All right, I didn't go see our next film either, 5 feet apart, but I really don't know much about it, but I do know, I think it's about Forbidden Love.
Well, did you see Fault in Our Stars?
I did.
Well, did you like it?
I didn't cry. And in fact, I just about vomited when they made out in Anne Frank's attic.
Yeah, you gotta let that one go. I remember now. But
we talked about
but
that.
But this is The Fault in Our Stars, not as good, but it is essentially the same kind of story where you have two teenagers who are both very ill. In Fault in Our Stars, it was cancer. In 5 Feet Apart, it's cystic fibrosis. So it's this chronic lung disorder, genetic disease that really leaves a lot of younger people in the hospital for much of their lives dealing with the medicine regimen and all that. And so in this one, you've got the forbidden love is between Stella, played by your girl, Hayley Lou Richardson.
Another Cinema Clash favorite. We love our Hayley Lou.
You gotta love your Hayley Lou. And so she plays this patient named Stella who meets this rebellious but charming fellow CF patient named Will Newman, played by Cole Sprouse, who I guess is on Riverdale. And so that's what he's known from, but I've never seen Riverdale.
Never seen it.
The thing is that he carries this really highly infectious bacteria that
that's attractive.
That if she catches it, like another cystic fibrosis patient, if they catch it, it can be lethal. And so, of course, there's this instant attraction between this pair.
The bad boy.
And they have to be kept 6 feet apart in order to not get
what
the potential of the contamination. And so as they get closer and closer together, the idea is that Stella, who has always been one of those ones who just plays by the rules, she's OCD when it comes to her medicine, she's just absolutely one of those ones who is just following the regimen, and Will is always the one who just sort of lives life on the edge and is just willing to put himself in danger. But then as he draws closer to Stella, he's not willing to put her in danger. And she then decides basically that my point of defiance is I'm going to claim 1 foot back. Therefore, it's called 5 feet apart as opposed to 6 feet apart.
I think our listeners can hear the face I'm making right now.
I know. But the thing is, it is Hayley Lou. And she is so good that she elevates what would otherwise be a TV movie, Lifetime Disease of the Week movie. That's what this would be without Hayley Lou Richardson, because she's so good that you buy into her story. And for anyone who's not familiar with cystic fibrosis, I mean, this movie does not hide the symptoms, and there's no treatment, there's no cure, there's only all these drugs and things that can try and help mitigate the symptoms. And a lot of people need a lung transplant. And so the character, of course, is waiting for a lung transplant as well. But it's shedding light on that disease. And I mean, you see the G-tubes and the thick mucus that they cough up, and the tremendous amount of medications that they have to take, and the pressures that they're under with trying to not get sick again. And it all takes place essentially in this hospital. So it's not even, unlike Fault in Our Stars, which takes you to places like Amsterdam, this one all stays pretty much within the confines of the hospital. And if you didn't have Hayley Lou Richardson just really driving this film, it would be a harder sell. But it's good for the young adult crowd that it's actually targeting to. For everyone else, I mean, it's you. If you would cringe at major chunks of it, but you would like, still think you would appreciate Hayley Lou Richardson's performance. And then there's this other guy, Moises Arias, who is in The Kings of Summer. He plays like her gay bestie, who's in the hospital as well, and he's really good. And there's also the watchful nurse who's there named Barb, whose job it is to keep these kids from getting too close and from not following the protocols. So, you know, it's not nearly as good as The Fault in Our Stars. And I personally hated the ending of this particular film. But the YA folks in the crowd did seem to pretty much enjoy it. And there were a lot of VIPs there representing like the Cystic Fibrosis Foundation, and they all seemed to really appreciate that this film took a very realistic view and a rare view of what it's like to live with cystic fibrosis.
You had me at thick mucus.
I figured as much.
From your synopsis, from your description, it actually doesn't sound like The Fault in Our Stars to me. It sounds like everything. You remember Amanda Stenberg couldn't leave her house because she was like a bubble girl?
It's a little bit of that. It's got.
She was obsessed with watching The Bad Boy Next Door.
But The Bad Boy Next Door wasn't sick. And so with Fault in Our
but
Stars.
But he could kill her by like sneezing on her.
I do remember that one. But no, this one is much more straightforward with the illnesses. But and it's got the melodramatic score that you would hate because it's telling you what to feel at a lot of times and trying to get you to cry. But the bottom line of both the movies, of Fault in Our Stars and this one, is that any chronic terminal disease sucks. And love can't always conquer all, but it's worth the fight anyway. Oh, so both God. Of those films kind of have that same message. And Haley Lou Richardson has always just shown us that she can really play a lot of different roles. You know, we just saw her in Support the Girls.
Haley Lou Richardson is spectacular. We first mentioned her in The Edge of 17 when she was second fiddle to Haley Steinfeld. Then we saw her in Columbus, one of my top 10 films of the year, as she was acting against John Cho, hanging around Columbus, Indiana. And then, yeah, Support the Girls, she was supporting Regina Hall. I remember raving about that film when we were talking about it, and good old Haley Lou. I'm sad she has fallen to Lifetime movie schlock.
But she elevates it, so she made what would otherwise be schlock a little more believable.
Jesus loves you, Schmel Schmoo. All right,
you're gonna have to explain that one. Coming from to dust.
No, you know what? If you're a longtime listener, you'll understand that. Our next film, I also didn't want to go see because I've seen it before. How is that possible, you ask? Because in 2013, I saw the Chilean version called Gloria, with the same director, Sebastián Lelio. He was much better a couple years later with his Oscar nod in the Best Foreign Film category. With a fantastic woman. Loved that movie. So they wanted Gloria to make a little bit more money. Therefore, they Americanized it. Intouchables, The Upside, In Order of Disappearance, Cold Pursuit. And those are both this year. So now Gloria Bell. So you won't know it's a remake because it gave her a surname.
That's right.
And it's the same
movie.
The same film. The same scenes, the same dialogue, the same movements, many of the same songs. They're both singing Gloria. And
Laura Branigan, baby.
It still worked for me. Julianne Moore takes the place of Paulina Garcia, who did it just fine in the Chilean version. She is over 50. She is divorced. She is single. She goes to these nightclubs, and I'm going to ask you, do these nightclubs exist where people over 50 who are obviously all divorced and looking for companionship go to these kind of laid-back, quieter nightclubs that play 70s disco funk, and they're not shy. They know why they're there, and they're like, hey, maybe we're compatible, maybe not. And I really want to know if those places exist because I want to go to one.
It's supposed to be L.A., so I don't know. Maybe it's like in the Valley or something. But I certainly don't think that La La Land probably would not have showcased this particular bar scene.
She's a strong woman. You know, she's not at home at night crying like Bridget Jones to Celine Dion. She's out there. She's doing things. She goes to yoga class. She has lunch with her mother. She has friends. She has a good job at an insurance company. And she does not take garbage, does not take crap from her male suitors. She meets Arnold, played by John Turturro. And he is fresh off a divorce, fresh off gastric bypass surgery. He's lost like 200 pounds and he is out there now. I'm ready to experience life, Gloria Bell. You intrigue me. But first, let me get the phone. Because I need to tend to my ex-wife and my two miserable grown daughters and leave you and shove you aside. And she's like, all right, you don't have time for me. I don't have time for you. she's so strong that way. I saw someone like, oh man, get ready for the new superhero film of the year. You think Captain Marvel? No, Gloria Bell.
Oh no, not even close. No, no, no.
This was, for a long time, 100% on Rotten Tomatoes. It finally got its first rotten score, so it's 56-1. Slant Magazine gave it a rotten. 56 other people gave it high marks. Some said it's Julianne Moore's best performance ever.
What?
I'm not saying it is, because she's actually, when you get down to brass tacks, she is copying another actress's performance. It's very similar. The film has already been made. The shots are the same, but in America instead of Chile, which bugs the heck out of me. But gosh darn it, I have a soft spot for anyone that sings Air Supply in the car.
Hey, I do have that soft spot. I can totally meet you at Air Supply and Laura Branigan. But I did not particularly like this movie, and I didn't see the original Gloria, the Chilean version. I remember Artie Chick, though, had reviewed it for Chick Flick, so I didn't bother, because I remember her noting she really liked it, and she saw it as this glass half full, strong woman, very much like you did, and that she liked that it was showcasing a real woman, warts and all.
She
and,
got warts.
But she had... At the time, she had noted that a friend of hers who was about my age and status was saying that she thought it was sad. She saw it as more of a sad movie, maybe glass half empty, I don't know. But I did too. I found her situation really sad. And I didn't like her all that much. I thought, you're talking about how, well, he's sort of ignoring her and all that. But there's like this whole dinner scene where she's hanging out with her ex-husband and her kid and ignoring him, and then gets pissed off when he disappears from the scene.
What, you're on his side on that?
On that one, I totally got why he left. I know, but she was ignoring it.
No, suck it up. Suck it up.
But
it's someone's birthday party.
But the thing is that I did not see any chemistry between Julianne Moore and John Turturro. I just didn't, so I didn't buy into their relationship.
I wasn't rooting for their relationship either. I was hoping she'd run the other direction from him. He's not ready for a relationship.
But I didn't see any reason for her being the way that she was to stick with him as long as she didn't to begin with, because I just didn't see any real connection there. And so I just think that Julianne Moore's always good. You know, she's sort of like the Haley Lou Richardson for the older set.
No.
She's always good.
That's a little step forward there.
But she's always good. I've never really not liked Julianne Moore in a performance, but I did not like this movie. And so other than, and I don't understand the point. If I think it's still targeting the exact same people that would have liked Gloria in 2014,
but I know
13.
Why they did it, because nobody saw Gloria in this country other than me and
did
Artie Chick.
Did anybody see Cold Pursuit when they had seen An Order of Disappearance?
No, because nobody saw An Order of Disappearance. But that's why they're remaking this
but
stuff.
But I don't think, right, but I don't, I think they're shooting themselves in the foot, because I think you've got the same target audience. I think it's the same people that might have seen the original that may go see this one.
More people are going to see this movie.
I don't think, but I don't think far more people are really going to like it. And so I think you're going to end up with just with a minimal audience of and mixed reviews, because I just think
this is not going to break the box office. Mm-mm. But you have missed the mark, Hannah. What do you mean mixed reviews? It's blowing off the charts.
The audience reviews.
No, they are not going to see a sad film here. There, people get divorced, and she, instead of staying home and saying, that's it, I had my go around. She has relationships with her two children. She's going out there. She goes to these. They're laying on the floor just laughing,
it is definitely geared towards. It's a movie for grown-ups. But I don't think all grown-ups are going to like it. I think it's going to be one of those ones that the few people that did see or hear about the original Gloria are maybe out of curiosity going to see this one. And if it's not better and it's a shot-by-shot remake, what is the point?
I agree with you. What is the point? The point is they're wise enough to know nobody going to see this knows it's a remake. They haven't heard of the Chilean film because only certain people know about Chilean films.
But it's not good enough to be great enough to capture that big of an audience, even as a remake.
Julianne Moore has pull. She will get an audience. No, it's not going to break the box office, but people are really going to get attached to her. They're going to like her. They want to see what she does. They're going to root for her. And it has a we're going to make you feel old moment. Michael Cera, little Michael Cera,
that did make me
from sad. Superbad, plays a father.
Yeah, that was painful. That was definitely painful.
That one hurt.
But I'm telling you, I just think that it's going to be the same reaction that Jill pointed out several years ago with the original Gloria, that she really liked it much the same way that you did for the same reasons. And another person that she talked to didn't like it for the same reasons that I don't particularly like it.
Yeah. I almost want to do like a wine bet on this.
We got to figure out stakes on that because I'm not sure how in the world.
The movies for grown-ups, all the older couples, and especially I think the divorced women who go see this film, are going to identify with her and fall in love with her.
I just don't think that many are going to see it. So you can say
they're not going to Wonder Park.
They're not going to Wonder Park. They're probably not going to go to 5 feet apart. I don't know. But we'll have to figure out some kind of wager. Is there a minimum for these kinds of films that you consider?
I don't even know how many screens it's opening on.
I don't know. But it's all for you.
This is going to last. So remember how we didn't do financial bet on it, but we just, which one would latch on? Eighth Grade or Blindspotting, and I clearly won the hell out of that bet. I think this is going to latch on.
All right, we shall see.
All right,
we'll bet something. If it does latch on, as you claim, then I guess we'll know about it in the next week or two, and I will bring some good wine. And
I like how that adjective kind of is an homage to what I usually serve.
Versus your warm sangria.
You know, I'm going to ignore that. Okay. But it's still upstairs, by the way, if you want to finish that bottle.
That's okay.
Our next film I watched, and you didn't, Mapplethorpe, about the artist Robert Mapplethorpe. I had only heard of him through another artist. I didn't know who he was. I knew about him through Patti Smith. Patti Smith, the musician of, you know, because the original Because the Night, before 10,000 Maniacs covered it. Back in the day, Patti Smith and Robert Mapplethorpe lived together as starving artists in the Chelsea Hotel. And I know about this because when her autobiography was released, Rolling Stone did like, here's a chapter of it, and we love Patti Smith. So I read it, it's like, oh, she lived with a guy named Robert Mapplethorpe. That's the only way I knew. Now it's like, oh, they made a movie about that guy, Patti Smith's guy. Apparently he was famous in his own right.
Wait, so were you not remember, or were you too young during the whole controversy about his exhibit being pulled?
I was too young. I didn't know.
The reason I had no interest in seeing this film is that I actually remember that whole controversy, and I had no interest in his art then.
I didn't know what kind of artist he was until this film, and I didn't know the exhibit got pulled.
And I knew all of that, which is why I kind of decided to opt out of it. But anyway, what did you think?
Well, so it turns out Robert Mapplethorpe is an explicit artist, and this film is very explicit. It shows the art, and it shows him making the art. He's very fond of the shocking black and white contrast,
like homoerotic
of male
stuff, right?
Genitalia.
Yes, I remember it was.
And some of it is tasteful male genitalia, and some of it is, oh my lord,
it was meant to shock. It is
shocking. And he broke away from his family. He is this confused Catholic, if you will. His dad is very strict, and he does not understand the alternative lifestyles. And when Robert tells his dad, hey, I'm into photography, I want to be a photography artist, his dad thinks, oh, you're into developing and in the dark room and chemicals. Like, no, I have someone else do that. I set up the shot. And his dad does not understand that. The film switches every now and then from, I think it's shot on digital, but then it switches to like 8mm old stock footage of New York City, which is, oh, okay, you're setting a time and place, but it's a little cheesy. Bronski beats on the soundtrack, so it already gets another half star right there, but it's an anachronism. So this takes place over like 10 years, from like 72 to 80, 82, 83. Then the HIV epidemic hits New York, and all of his, really his friends and his subjects of his art start dying. And he, at the beginning of the film, I don't know if he knew he was gay or if he was just hiding it. Patty didn't know until he started doing his art. And it's like, is there something you want to tell me here? And I get, the film alleges he did not know he was gay until they moved into the Chelsea Hotel. And then he, oh my Lord, I am not just gay. I'm extremely, extremely gay. So Patty Smith runs away for the rest of the film, which is sad. I miss her. Make a film about Patty Smith. He's not a nice guy. Robert Mapplethorpe is mean. He is mean to his the people he shoots. He's mean to his boyfriends. He his little brother comes to latch on to him, says, hey, I need to get out of the house too. Help me. And so he asks the question all older brothers ask of their little brothers. You want to do some cocaine? Yeah, I wasn't feeling it just because you're not rooting for him. He's a mean dude. And even when he gets sick, you're like, all right, that's... He spreads it kind of willfully. His brother calls him out on it. It's like, you can't go party. Do you know you're hurting people? You're spreading. Is like, and he has like an excuse for it. Good, you know, I'm sick. My don't. It's like, whoa, this guy's kind of a bad dude. A lot of producers, but one of the producers is Eliza Dushku. I have no idea the connection there.
Yeah, interesting.
So, you know, I did not know that he was this, you know, more than edgy, this flamboyant, in-your-face, I want to shock you artist. I had no idea. Now I know, not recommending the film, even for people that know the guy. I don't know, the art is intriguing at times. He took interesting pictures, but...
Yeah, well, you can find the pictures anywhere, but I thought initially when you... talked about seeing Mapplethorpe that it was a documentary.
I thought it was too.
I didn't realize that it was actually going to be a biopic of sorts, and that's weird to me. So the fact that maybe I would have had a sliver of interest as a documentary, I have zero interest as an actual drama.
It's weird to make a biopic of not only an anti-hero, but of like a villain. Like no one wants to hang out with Robert Mapplethorpe. He is just messed up.
Yeah.
And it's a very brave to make this film that way, of a guy that nobody's going to like, that I guess has made a lasting impact with his art. I guess it's still out there. His little brother is still in the business. But,
well, and I think Patti Smith is out there sort of promoting to some degree.
She's still around.
Talking about their relationship. But I will give you that Gloria Bell should and will do better than Mapplethorpe in theaters.
Thank you for admitting that. Look, I'm already going to win this bet
No. I'm giving you Gloria Bell over Mapplethorpe.
Mapplethorpe will not latch on.
No.
It will not.
No.
But what? So our last film that we're going to talk about is You Shot It My Way. Because of the director. It was kind of a motif last year that famous actors directed their first film. And this might be 29's first instance of that, even though this premiered way long ago at 2018's Sundance. So tell us about Yardy, directed by Idris Elba.
Well, when I first got the information about seeing Yardy, I did not pay enough attention. And when I saw that it was an Idris Elba film, I actually thought it was going to be with Idris Elba in it.
Nope.
But no, it's his directorial debut. And it's a period film set in 1973 and 1983, and it goes between Kingston, Jamaica, where there's sort of this gang warfare going on the streets, and London in this Hackney neighborhood where all these Jamaican, where it's a Jamaican community in London. And so it's ultimately about this boy who lost his way and chose the wrong path in life and became sort of a gang member and a drug runner when he had sworn that off or as a youngster. And it's based on this best-selling novel by Victor Headley. I'd never heard of the novel, but apparently it was one of these books that Idris Elba just read as a youth, identified with, and loved. And so that's why it was a labor of love for him to get the rights to this book and to do this film. And it's really just about the cycle of violence and children caught in the crossfire. and, you know, and migration issues, you know, going from Jamaica to London. And I don't know, it was different. I liked it well enough. I didn't love it, but it was just sort of one of those little indies that was very gritty and worked. I wouldn't have chosen it without the Idris Elba connection, but it was kind of interesting.
You can tell Yardi is an adapted screenplay. There's this epic character arc from 12-year-old to 22-year-old. 10 to 20, mm-hmm. whatever, you know, those 10 years. This is epic arc. Dennis, you know, he's told way too overtly, there's the path of the righteous and the path of the damned. And when his older brother, who he loves, Jerry Dredd, is murdered in cold blood trying to bring the two warring gangs together, Dennis sees who did it. So he knows, and he's sworn vengeance. And every time something almost goes good in his life or he's going to get on the right track, vengeance trips him up. And he does something stupid because he's so mad. He never got over it. His older brother was killed, and he feels guilty. He thinks he kept his older brother on Earth as a ghost because he disrupted some sacred traditional Jamaican ritual. So instead of going off to heaven, Jerry Dredd still roaming the Earth, and he sees him every now and then as a ghost. I liked Yardi only for the cultural aspect. Seeing Kingston in 73, seeing East London in 83, I could care less about the really episodic, poorly edited, especially the second half of the movie, where he falls in with this DJ sound crew, and one of the kids ends up dying, but that's just kind of written away. Very poorly edited film. I sort of like this film, but I nowhere near love it. I don't really like it. I
know. Actually, this one we can kind of agree on is I sort of liked it, but there were some flaws in the storytelling. But there's a sweet little side story though, where when the character D for Dennis goes off to London, it also happens to be where his estranged girlfriend has gone to live to escape the violence and is raising their little girl. And so she's like his only hope of salvation, and you see that, and it's like, can he do the right thing? Can he find the right way without jeopardizing yet again this potentially good relationship with this woman? And the woman, Chantal Jackson, I think it's her first ever like feature film role. So she's from TV. And I think she does a good job. What was very interesting is Ami Amin, who plays Dee, he met Idris Elba on a plane, and Idris Elba had seen him in The Maze Runner and said, "Oh, you know, hey, I have this screenplay here. You should read it. And I really think you could play the lead." The next 11 hours on their transatlantic flight, he read the script and had a job by the time the plane landed. So, you know, that's how he came to
meet up. Transatlantic flight takes 11 hours.
I think they were probably going from like
was
LA
it like
to
San
London.
Francisco or something?
Yeah, it was probably like LA to London or something.
Good Lord, 11 hours.
So,
but
I'm not sure. But it's a cool little, it's like a little side story.
It's missing
something.
Cinematics. It's missing a flow.
Well, the other thing that's really strange to get used to, and when the film first started and had subtitles, I was like, wait a minute,
you need them.
Isn't this in English? But it is in Jamaican, man.
Yeah.
And you realize that you are having a really hard time understanding that even though they are speaking English, it is a dialect, a Jamaican slang.
But you understand everything, because I was reading the subtitles, but I was picking up half the words they were saying.
But I was picking up half the words, so yeah. I could see that if you didn't put the subtitles there,
I would have died.
You would not make it through this film. So I suppose if you're of Jamaican heritage and your ear is trained, you could watch it without having to read it as well. But yeah, I agree with you. I just I wanted to like it so much more, and you know, and I want to champion Idris Elba's passion for this project, and that this book meant a lot to him in his youth. But it's a tough one because it's going to be really hard to encourage anybody to necessarily go and seek it out.
I'm honestly surprised it's got American distribution. Yeah. It's already, it got a lot of British support because of who Idris Elba is over there. But it didn't get a lot of distribution over here. It's playing the smallest theater in D.C.
Yeah, but he was hosting Saturday Night Live last week. And so I think he was doing it actually to promote Yardi.
He wasn't doing it to get cast as James Bond?
No, I think he was doing it to promote Yardi. I think he was actually wearing a Yardi shirt.
It's in a theater that only a select clientele goes to.
Yeah, but I think that that obviously his appearance on SNL was meant to at least try and give it a little bump. Whether that does, I'm not really sure.
This will not latch on.
But still better than Mapplethorpe.
It is better than Mapplethorpe, but it's not as good as Wonder Park.
No. I mean,
and that's not good.
No, I mean it's very gritty, and if you like the gang,
it's just so cliche.
It did feel very cliche, but good on Idris for jumping into the directorial game, and hopefully he'll just improve and get to do it if that's what he wants to be doing.
I imagine there's a bunch of reviewers out there saying, don't quit your day job.
Just stick with, Bond. Stick with the Bond thing to see if that can happen for you.
All right. Agree or disagree, Hannah.
Yes.
Nicole Holofcener was right to fire Oscar winner Julianne Moore from Can You Ever Forgive Me and then hire Melissa McCarthy.
The thing is, nobody really explained why she was fired.
They had creative differences.
Yeah. So I think it would have been a very different film if Julianne Moore had been in Can You Ever Forgive Me? I did not love Can You Ever Forgive Me. I really liked the story. And I thought Melissa McCarthy, did a great job in that role, but it didn't make me like the movie all that much more. So I'm not so sure. I might have actually been okay with a version. Maybe the creative differences that Julianne Moore was promoting would have made me actually like this film more.
It's tough to see because, you only identify Lee Israel with Melissa McCarthy now. You can't unsee that.
No, but then I would just sort of say, hey, let's swap. Can you imagine any
Melissa McCarthy is Gloria movie? Bell. That,
yeah,
or
exactly.
Still Alice.
But you know what? I can. I actually could. I think I could see Melissa McCarthy as Gloria Bell, not as Still Alice, but I can see her potentially as Gloria. So, it's very interesting to look at these two very different actresses, but I'm not sure if she was right or not, because I think since I didn't love that film, there was just a piece of it that wasn't working for me. Maybe Julianne Moore's creative vision would have actually worked. I don't know. My only one, I agree or disagree. So I was reading that Annapurna Studios released three movies on Christmas Day: If Beale Street Could Talk, Vice, and Destroyer with Nicole Kidman. Got plenty of critical buzz, even some award season love. Lost about $20 million. And so agree or disagree that these were not films that should have been released on Christmas Day.
There's two things.
Not Christmas movies.
There's two things to talk about here. You release movies on Christmas Day if you want Oscar attention. Therefore, they knew the only Oscar attention Destroyer was going to get was for Nicole Kidman. Therefore, you release it late, you get and they knew If Beale Street Could Talk and Vice are also awards contenders. That's why you release on Christmas Day. However, Annapurna, I know the casual listener does not pay attention to this, is the laughingstock of distribution companies. On one hand, you have an amazing company like A24 that routinely just knows how to distribute and market films. Then you have Annapurna, which apparently, I don't want to, slam certain or name individuals, but their head chairwoman, their CEO, whoever, the lady running it, she's a butt of a lot of Twitter jokes. And if you follow certain forums and film forums, she's a joke. She doesn't know what she's doing. She's a daddy's girl, was handed a distribution company. And just does not know when and how to market and release films. No, so stacking these three from the same distributor on top of each other on Christmas Day, it was all, they were always going to kill each other. They were gonna, there's the same audience for them.
It was a marketing, a huge marketing error, but also I remember when I saw these, each one, I was like, none of these to me is appropriate for a Christmas Day release because people want an escape. They want something that's either fun or incredibly action-oriented or just a solid drama with mass appeal. And these three just didn't, none of them had it. I think it was a huge disappointment. It was a waste of Nicole Kidman because she's very good in Destroyer, and it just was not a Christmas Day movie. Vice, it was like nobody wants to see, to be reminded of our current state of political affairs at Christmas right now. And If Beale Street Could Talk just wasn't the right vibe for a Christmas release. I think it should have been released a little differently, a little earlier. So
these three films should have been released 1 month apart each in October, a November, and a December. I don't really care about the order. Maybe Vice in November, since that's, you know, the election season. But these are art house independent films. They have the same audiences. You cannot release them on the same day. They cannibalize each other. That was a stupid move.
Yeah, I agree.
Anyways, recapping. Man, you spun me up on that question.
Sorry.
I didn't know that was coming, so it was a good blindside because I have a definite opinion about Annapurna.
Who knew? I didn't even realize I was going there, but hey.
Wonder Park. If your kid knows about it like mine does, he's really going to want to go. Because I don't have the heart to tell him that certain movies just stink. Or I told him I'm not going. If he wants to go, his mom's going to take him. I can't see this movie twice.
Yeah, it's not the kind of movie you'd ever want to see twice, but it's one that you can survive sitting through once.
5 feet apart.
5 feet apart, YA crowd. If you really are into the forbidden teen romance, tearjerker, disease of the week kind of thing in a Fault in Our Stars kind of way, then absolutely go for it. If not, then you'll want to stay away.
Let me know when they get 2 inches apart and it turns into like a zombie film.
No spoilers, but maybe it does.
I feel weird saying it, but Gloria Bell is the best film of the week. I've never say that about a remake, and I didn't love it, but it's kind of a downer week for new movies. Just watching Julianne Moore get up and dance to Gloria by Laura Branigan is reason enough to go.
I can just play my Air Supply LP and perhaps listen to Gloria on my 80s channel on Sirius XM and do without this movie. So I disagree with you. I just don't think it's I don't think it's the best movie of the week unless you are absolutely looking for a movie strictly for a mature audience.
I was too young in the 80s to know what was going on with Robert Mapplethorpe. So I did learn a lot from Mapplethorpe, the biopic. Now I'm caught up with the rest of the world, and I honestly don't feel the richer for it.
I was old enough in the 80s to know that I had absolutely no interest in seeing this film.
Yardy will be forgotten, and it will be a trivia question on what was Idris Elba's first movie as a director. It's fun to watch Jamaicans because you rarely see them on their own film, but man, I wish it was good.
It's gritty. I just wish it were better.
Well done. All right. Well, thank you very much for listening to the Cinema Clash. I am Charlie Jewell.
I'm Hannah Bookdahl. Thank you. Take care.